Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Everybody knows. Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe still picking cotton for your ribbons and your bows. Yep, everybody knows. And welcome to the Lifeboat Hour on this last show of the month as we move closer and closer to the end of 2014. I really appreciate your tuning in tonight. We have no guests tonight because I decided to take this time to have another fireside chat with all of you. Our guest last week was the fabulous Mimi Gurman, who needs no introduction to most of you. She shared with us last week the impact that spending time with the late Brittany Maynard had on her, and how doing body work on Brittany, who had moved to Oregon to die with dignity, affected Mimi's perspective on a number of things. As always, if you missed the show, you can find it in the archives at prn.fm. Click on Shows and scroll down to the Lifeboat Hour. The archives last week had some technical issues, but normally our shows are archived within 24 hours of airing. There are a number of things I want to talk about tonight, and I'll be playing a couple of songs as well, so let's get on with it. What a week it has been with another metastasis of the cancer of racism in the United States and all of the wrong questions being asked in the mainstream media about what happened in Ferguson, Missouri on August 9th of this year. This week, we've seen some 200 protests or more across the United States against the grand jury decision not to indict police officer Darren Wilson for shooting Michael Brown on August 9th. But I'd like to step back from the mainstream media for a moment and ask some different kinds of questions tonight. This week, I heard a terrifying statistic that every 28 hours, a Black person in the United States is killed by a police officer. Think about that for a moment. I lived through the civil rights movement and the racial turmoil of the 60s and 70s, and I wouldn't trade my involvement in that movement for anything. I will remember what it was like in this country in the 50s when I was a child, but on one level, while some of my peers might say that there's no comparison to the 50s and now in this country, I beg to differ. On the one hand, there's no comparison in terms of what is now socially acceptable regarding the treatment of African Americans. Yet, on the other hand, little has changed in the hearts of white Americans with respect to people of color, because the roots of racism, which run to the depths of the earth and the depths of our psyches, have not been addressed. Many would tell you that we need more education. If people just have more information about ethnicity and more diversity training, they'll behave differently. Again, I beg to differ. One thing that brings people together in their depths is grief. We can have glorious diversity trainings and multicultural celebrations that make our hearts soar with a sense of bridging ethnic gaps and racial divides, but throughout all of our valiant efforts, we do not touch each other's hearts. And I want to make very clear that I support all of the protests across this nation that march in solidarity with Michael Brown and his family in Ferguson. But I have to wonder what would happen, really, what might happen if white and African American people came together all over this country, in addition to the protests, to grieve together. What might happen to all of us if we did that? Every time I see Michael Brown's mother, I want to get down on my knees and grieve with her. And not just Michael Brown's mother, but the families of all people of color who are murdered by white police officers. We live in a culture of polarities, The paradigm of industrial civilization is all about polarities, opposites, differences, divides. But what happens when people refuse to play that game anymore and say, no, I'm not going to live my life based on separation? I know that we are all fundamentally connected in our core, and I'm going to risk stepping out of the paradigm of separation and live differently. This week, I read the story of African-American musician Daryl Davis, who, over the course of several years, befriended not one, but several Ku Klux Klan members. He's written a book about it called Clandestine Relationships. There's also an excellent story in the online publication The Guardian Liberty Voice, entitled KKK member walks up to a black Muslim, black musician in a bar, but it's not a joke. And what happens next will astound you. And it was written by Rebecca Savastio. I really want to read Davis's book because the story for me is absolutely riveting. How an African-American befriends members, not just one, but several of the KKK, and actually develops a friendship. But these kinds of stories of people bridging huge ethnic and cultural divides don't happen as a result of more diversity training. They happen in people's hearts as a result of honest, transparent, patient, and I might add, very risky encounters. There's a deep, deep, raw, bleeding wound in the psyches of all Americans, black and white. The wounds are different for blacks than they are for whites. Theirs are the wounds of being ripped from their homeland centuries ago, being brought to this land and hideously enslaved by the white power elite. Theirs are the wounds of living in a dominant culture that, since the end of the Civil War, has pretended that everything that created the wounding of black America has been healed. It's over. It's done. It's behind us. Let's talk about how the civil rights movement of the 60s took care of all that, and let's pretend that we don't have to go deeper in the healing process. For white America, the wounds have to do with our unconscious culpability and our refusal to deal with our own racism, refusing to understand that healing our institutionalized racism is a lifelong process that few of us are willing to engage in because it's a long, painful, humbling road. We carry in our bodies the weight of our ancestors' genocide of indigenous cultures and enslavement of black people. The long shadow of violence that we never witnessed firsthand, but nevertheless our ancestors experienced, weighs upon us. I know a little about this. I had ancestors who murdered the Potawatomi Indians in northern Indiana. I also had ancestors who managed an underground railroad depot and gave refuge to many slaves traveling to Canada. And I've walked the land where those two very different events happened. And I've stopped in quiet places on the land to mourn and speak to my ancestors and feel the disparate impacts of those events in my body. So what I'm arguing for here is the inner world, and the need to devote as much attention to it as we give the notion of so-called external solutions. I know many of you have amazing stories about this, and I'm sorry that we no longer take callers because I'd like to hear some of those. But we need to move on. And tonight, I want to talk about a number of seemingly different things, which are all connected in some way. And I'd like to continue my comments with this excerpt from a new book by Margaret Wheatley entitled, How Does Raven Know? Margaret says, I'm not interested in being hopeful or optimistic or working diligently to reverse the patterned path of history we tread so reliably toward collapse. I'm interested in being able to stay in the midst of this terrible travesty that degrades the human spirit or denies that we have one, caught in the balance beam of meaningful work and terrifying times. I want to walk steady in the world, learning what balance feels like, blessed by the active presence of companions in a sacred world. I like the way Margaret Wheatley describes her work. She says, "At this critical historic juncture, I now challenge leaders everywhere with these questions. Who do you choose to be for this time? Do you contribute to the deterioration of human capacity by your silence and compliance? Or do you act bravely and use your power and influence to champion the human spirit, using the resources available to create islands of sanity wherever you can?" And by leaders, Wheatley is not referring to world leaders, but leaders everywhere. Anyone who is awake and who cares passionately about this planet. Anyone listening to my voice right now is or has the potential to be a leader. I would simply add to her question the need to champion not only the human spirit, but the spirits of all living beings on the planet. She's asking a question that I ask all the time: what did you come here to do? And she's also asking if we're helping to create islands of sanity. What she asks us to do in the excerpt I just read is to continually practice living in a state of not knowing. But in order to do that, one needs companions on the journey, because it's so hard to hang out in not knowing anything with certainty. Even certainty about near-term extinction. Even certainty about our own death. The only thing certain about death is that we're going to die. The when, the where, the how, those are all uncertain. The poet Jane Hirschfield has said it best in her short poem, Against Certainty. Jane Hirschfield says, "There is something out in the dark that wants to correct us. Each time I think this, it answers that. Answers hard in the heart's grammar strictness. If I say then that, it too is taken away. Between certainty and the real, an ancient enmity. When the cat waits in the path hedge, no cell of her body is not waiting. This is how she is able so completely to disappear. I would like to enter the silence portion as she does, to live amid the great vanishing as a cat must live, one shadow fully at ease inside the other." One of the things I find truly disturbing in this time of decline and endings is the voracious, obsessive quest for certainty, especially by people who are awake to collapse and near-term extinction. I interact almost daily with people all over the world who are hell-bent on becoming certain about many things, so certain that they may never be able to be certain about it. They sit at their computers many hours a day and try to acquire certainty about things like where to live, or what career move to make, or how to survive global economic collapse. For many people, the possibility that clear guidance could be found anywhere but online is a totally foreign concept. Now, while I do honor and reinforce rational information about where to live and how to discover and follow our calling and how to protect ourselves financially in the wake of economic meltdown, what I also know is that when we limit ourselves to the left brain, which is actually a very small portion of who each of us is, we're much more likely to be misguided than well-informed. Thankfully, humans have the capacity to reason. You know, the left brain is a magnificent and wondrous aspect of the body. I deeply respect the Enlightenment thinkers such as Isaac Newton and John Locke, Voltaire, Immanuel Kant, David Hume, and others who helped move the Western world beyond superstition and religious repression in the 17th and 18th centuries. But we've come to believe that that contribution was much more valuable than it actually was. We've come to revere them to the point of quasi-worship in the Western world. They are the champions of certainty. But other great minds and hearts of the 19th and 20th centuries clearly revealed that the rational mind is only a small part of who we are, and that certainty is a very slippery slope which cannot be entirely trusted. You know, there are limitations to reason, and Charles Eisenstein talks about this in his phenomenal book, The Ascent of Humanity. And if you haven't read The Ascent of Humanity, you must. He says, reason cannot evaluate truth. Reason cannot apprehend beauty. Reason knows nothing of love. Living from the head brings us to the same place, whether as individuals or as a society. It brings us to a multiplicity of crises. The head tries to manage them through more of the same methods of control, and the crises eventually intensify. Eventually, they become unmanageable, and the illusion of control becomes transparent. The head surrenders, and the heart can take over once again. Let's pause for a moment and listen to a song that says this better than I can. It's from Portland vocalist Barbara Ford, written by Peter Mayer, and the title is My Soul. Let's listen.
My soul. together, my giant soul and tiny me, one resembling forever, one like smoke upon the breeze, one the deep abiding ocean, one a sudden flashing wave, counting galaxies like snowflakes, I would swear we were the same. Sacred stories to me, sanctifies my tiny life, lays a bridge across the ages, melts the boundaries of my bones, paints a bold eternal face on this passing moment, oh my soul.
That was My Soul from Barbara Ford, and this is the Lifeboat Hour. I'm your host, Carolyn Baker. So there's something greater than reason and the rational mind. Animals are not rational beings, and they acquire information from their bodies and their instincts. Because we've become so estranged from our bodies and our instincts as human animals, we know little of how to utilize them for guidance when we're confronted with major life dilemmas. Part of the work I do with folks is assist them in tuning in to these instincts and becoming familiar with what the body can tell them about where they need to be and what they need to be doing. For ancient humans, this was much less of a problem. Ancient cultures and indigenous tribes were so attuned to nature and their animal bodies that they were able to navigate their world much more easily than we're able to do in industrial growth societies. Ancient societies used story and myth as part of their global positioning system in walking on the earth. Carl Jung said that man has always lived in myth. And we think we're able to be born today and live in no myth and without history? He said, that's a mutilation of the human being. A mutilation of the human being. You see, humans for millennia used myth and story to make meaning. That's because humans are myth-making and meaning-making creatures. When we feel that our lives are meaningless, we don't thrive, and in fact, we really aren't very alive, which is why a sense of meaninglessness is such an enormous driver of addiction and suicide. For as long as humans have existed, we've had to deal with five things that science and the rational mind absolutely cannot help us deal with. Those are love, death, suffering, the sacred, and eternity. Myths were created as attempts to deal with these. Myths also connect us with everyone and everything else in the universe. One of the ways this connection happens through myth and story is that through myth and story, we experience emotions. And when we experience emotions, we're much more amenable to connection. Why? Because our hearts are opened by emotion, and particularly by the emotion of grief. This is why a group of people coming together to consciously grieve is a group of people who will invariably connect on a very deep emotional level. This is why grieving out in nature will facilitate falling in love with it all over again. And this is because we are nature and we are each other. We're not separate. I repeat, we are not separate from anyone or anything. As I said, one of the most powerful and profound books that I've read in the last 5 years is Charles Eisenstein's The Ascent of Humanity. It's a book that I return to repeatedly, can't seem to get enough of. And When I begin returning to a book over and over again, I know that it's a meaningful book. On page 239, he says, "The subjugation of all the earth's land and everything on and under it starts with a conceptual separation, an objectification of the world that facilitates its conversion first into resources, then into property, and finally into money." You know, I'm talking about this now in the webinar, and I'm talking about this in my 2015 book, Love in the Age of Ecological Apocalypse, because, you know, the ancients, our indigenous ancestors, looked at everything as a relationship. They looked at a mountain and they said, "Oh, that is a majestic, beautiful being." And they listened to the mountain, and they looked at the mountain, and they climbed the mountain, and they developed a relationship with it. And anything they developed a relationship with, including each other, they considered sacred. But industrial growth society came along and looked at the mountain with very different eyes and said, "Oh, that's a thing that probably has lots of resources in it. So let's go and take it and make it ours. Oh, and by the way, if you get there before I get there, I'm in trouble. So I'm going to have to kill you first so I can get to that mountain and make those resources mine." So in this time of near-term extinction and planetary hospice, one of the most, if not the most important thing we can and must be doing is realizing our interconnectedness and interdependence with all living beings. When we feel, smell, touch, and taste, and experience this on a bone marrow, cellular level, we're bathed in love, and we begin bathing everyone and everything else in love. The last two guests that we had on the Lifeboat Hour, Pauline Schneider and Mimi Gurman, have said at different points in their comments that they believe we come from the stars and that ultimately we are stardust. Yes, something greater than the rational mind and the human ego. And as the magnificent scientist Carl Sagan noted in the 1980s, "The nitrogen in our DNA," this is a quote from Sagan, "the nitrogen in our DNA, the calcium in our teeth, the iron in our blood, the carbon in our apple pies were made in the interiors of collapsing stars. We are made of star stuff." So as I was pondering these comments and preparing for the show, I knew I had to include this clip from Coldplay's new album. The song is "A Sky Full of Stars." Let's listen.
Cause you're a sky full of stars. I'm gonna give you my heart. Cause you're a sky full of stars. Cause you light up the path. In the sky,
That was Coldplay, A Sky Full of Stars, and this is the Lifeboat Hour. I'm your host, Carolyn Baker. And you are a sky full of stars. I believe, and I'm certainly endeavoring to live my life this way, that the most important thing I can be doing right now is falling back in love with the earth. Or perhaps falling in love with it for the first time, and that if I fall in love with the earth, I can't help but fall in love with you. For me, this is the true work of planetary hospice. And I also believe that when I fall back in love with you, when I'm willing to develop these risky relationships across divides that seem impossible to bridge, and when I'm willing to grieve with you, the planet is healed in some way or touched in some way. I'm not suggesting that the healing will save us from near-term extinction, but I am suggesting that falling in love with the earth and rediscovering what it means to love each other is the most important thing any of us can be doing right now. So, as many of you know, we're right in the middle of our six-session Thursday night webinar, Relationships in the Age of Ecological Apocalypse. How do we love? How do we leave? And that webinar is going to pick up again this coming Thursday night, December 4th. We skipped Thanksgiving week, but we're coming back again this Thursday with Francis Weller, who's been on the Lifeboat Hour twice in 2014, and whom I consider the foremost expert on grief in the United States. And our topic for this week is grief and love in a culture of congestive heart failure. If you want to register for this session or any of the single sessions or all of the recordings that you may have missed and the ones coming up, please visit syncchas.net, that's spelled syncchas.net. This is a wonderful place, not just to come and get more information, and indeed it is that, but it's a place to ask questions of these amazing guest speakers that we've had on the webinar. to share your thoughts and feelings, to disagree, and to meet other people of like heart and mind who are there for some of the same reasons you're there. It's a great way to begin to reach out and experience more community. So I want to invite you to join us as we begin again our webinar this coming Thursday night, December 4th, with Francis Weller. To register, go to Syncast, SYNCHCAST.net. I read an interesting quote this week on Chris Martinson's website. The title of that website is Peak Prosperity. And this was a quote by Andrew Graves. He says, "In the West, we've done a great job of exploring the external world, but have done absolutely nothing about exploring the internal world. And if the internal self is disordered, even if you have the right facts and ideas and are doing the right things, you'll just still create more disorder around you. If you aren't in the right place and don't have the right awareness, then your actions simply create more disorder. I'm sure we've all met people like that, where they are saying all the right things, but you just sort of feel like something is off." That's a quote from Andrew Graves on the Peak Prosperity website. Now, all of the issues that we're confronting right now on this planet are demanding not merely external solutions. They're demanding a transformation of consciousness. And I just like to reiterate something that many of you have heard me say before, but I don't think we can say it too often. It is very likely, if we look at what's happening with mythological eyes, with the eyes of story and poetry and song, with the eyes of our indigenous ancestors, we can see what's happening with a little different twist. And I'm not talking about a hopeful twist. I'm talking about just a different perspective that really makes what we're experiencing make sense in a way. Ever since I began writing about the collapse of industrial civilization, I have returned to the theme of planetary initiation, or a planetary rite of passage. You know, in all of the ancient indigenous cultures, and still in many today, when a child is born, it is assumed by the community that that child is bringing with it enormous gifts into the world. And in the Dagara tribe of West Africa, the elders actually put their ear to the belly of the pregnant mother to listen to what the child might be wanting to tell the community even before the child is born. And so, with this assumption that the child brings gifts, the community, the elders, the elder women, the elder men, nurture this child throughout its childhood, watching for those gifts, nurturing those gifts. And then at the age of puberty, approximately 12 or 13, the young men are taken out into nature by the men. The young women are taken out into nature by the older women. And they are asked to go through some sort of ordeal. Not because the elders are bored and have nothing to do, not because the elders are sadistic, but rather they know that at the core of this child is something greater than its ego, than its rational mind, than its physical being. They know that that something wants to come forth and be born in this child and cause this child to be much greater than he or she would be otherwise. They also know that this ordeal is dangerous because it's always a brush with death. And there's no guarantee that the child is going to survive. And yet, they believe that this initiation, this rite of passage, is so important that they are willing to risk even the death of the child. And so the child is taken out for several days, sometimes a week, sometimes longer, to go through this ordeal. And he or she is surrounded by, supported by the elders. But they must pass through this ordeal alone. And so, in the crux of this ordeal, the young person is forced to reach down deep within him or herself and find that something greater. In the midst of an ordeal that feels absolutely impossible to keep going through, the young person has to draw on these resources. Yes, those gifts that he or she brought with them into this world. And assuming that the young person does not perish, the young person is then taken back to the village. He or she is celebrated, honored, and now seen as a man or a woman. And he or she takes their place in the community. They begin to serve the community so that as they age, they become elders, and they can then pass on their wisdom to young people and help initiate other young people in these rites of passage. These are the kinds of rituals, ceremonies, celebrations that indigenous cultures discovered over thousands of years are absolutely essential to keep their tribes going, to sustain their community, to keep intact the principles on which their communities were built. And of course, we've lost those rites of passage. We don't have those anymore in traditional Western society. But Carl Jung, the wonderful psychologist that I talk about so often, he traveled all over the world in his lifetime studying indigenous cultures and these rites of passage. And as he returned from those places and he really thought and wrote about what those rites of passage were all about, he said, you know, we don't have those literal rites of passage in our Western civilization. What we have are symbolic initiations. Initiations that take place in the events of our lives that often drag us down to the core that the young person who's literally being initiated in a tribe is forced to experience. I'm talking about things like divorce, relationship endings, the death of a loved one, huge losses, a loss of a job, the loss of a body part, a terminal illness, a bankruptcy, a foreclosure, a shattering of dreams. Those are initiations. And initiations, whether they are literal or symbolic, force us to confront death. Maybe it's not a literal death that we confront. Maybe it's the death of something we had placed our hopes in. The death of a dream. The death of a goal. The death of something that was really important and meaningful to us. And in these symbolic initiations, our task is to see them as initiations, first of all, and secondly, to surrender to them. I'm not talking about liking them and wildly embracing them, but recognizing them as initiations and surrendering to what the initiation has to teach us. Because, you know, the physical survival is not the most important piece. The most important piece is the transformation of consciousness. So I wanted to say a little bit about planetary initiation because I believe that's where we are. That's what we are confronting at this time. And tonight I'd like to finish with this quote. One of my favorite people is physicist Brian Swim. Many of you may be familiar with his work. He has done a great deal of work on the universe story. He has a DVD by that title. He has a website by that title. And one of the speakers on our webinar, Ann Amberg, who will be speaking to us on December 11th, is a student of Brian Swim, and she's going to be talking about the universe story, what the universe does, and how the universe does it through us. And so back to this notion of we are stardust, Brian Swim says, one of the gifts of science is to realize what is surging through us in every moment of our life, with every breath we take, is the sun. It is surging into the life of the earth and all beings, in the fish, in the mammals, in the human. We are the sun in a new form. I want to thank all of you for joining me tonight on the Lifeboat Hour. The archive of this show should be up within 24 hours. You can catch it at prn.fm, go to shows, and scroll down to the Lifeboat Hour. I appreciate all of you so much. I appreciate your comments on Facebook, your emails. I appreciate your telling other people about this show. And it is my honor and pleasure to be the host of this show. I will be forever grateful to Mike Rupert for entrusting me with this show. And I bless all of you as we go now into this last month of 2014. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain lied. Everybody got this broken feeling like their father or their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. Everybody wants a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows.